You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Bring a partner to the ceilidh. Dress informal, the invite stated, at the Time Travellers Convention. Mary, Queen of Scots, arrived herself, signed up for speed dating, said she was a romantic, could lose her heed o'er the richt chiel. The sheik in the tartan trousers turned out to be Robbie Burns, with a bevy of beauties he'd gathered in his travels. John Knox took charge of the raffle, the kirk being east to collecting. Nobody sought him for a lady's choice. Lord Byron never missed a single dance in the gay gardens. He was last to leave. The Loch Ness Monster, playing water music, last seen, was reeling round by Ailsa Craig, with 13 kelpies and a Shetland silky. Feedback suggests they'll all be back next year.
Hello and welcome to the Scottish Poetry Library podcast. My name's Colin Waters and I'm terribly sorry to inform you I shall be your host for the next 30 minutes of chat and poetry, both of which, I'm glad to report, are mostly provided by Aberdeen's Sheena Blackhall. She's a poet, novelist, short story writer, illustrator, hang on, there's more, traditional storyteller and singer who is the author, as you'll hear, of over 100 poetry pamphlets. Born in 1947 in Aberdeen, she was the daughter of the manager of Strachan's Deeside Omnibus Service. After a year's study at Gray's School of Art, Blackhall passed a teaching diploma and worked for a time as a special needs teacher. But it's her work as a poet that we're going to be concentrating on in this podcast. Indeed, in 2009, she was made Aberdeen's Macker, or Poet Laureate is another way you might put it. She writes in English, Scots, and Doric. Now, if you're listening outside of Scotland, Doric is one of the country's languages, one that's heard mostly in the northeast. As a child and as a native speaker of Doric, she faced the same prejudices and challenges that speakers of minority languages around the world have faced, and she explains all about that during the course of the interview. As you'll hear during the podcast, Sheena is very candid about her early ambitions and breakdowns, as well as her love of Aberdeen, the worst place she's ever written a poem, and why she's written so many pamphlets.
What was your earliest experiences and memories of poetry? How did poetry introduce itself to your life?
My mother had, she was educated in a very small rural school because she was a farmer's daughter. So when she was small, she went from the very small rural school. Her father died and she was sent into town to live with maiden aunts in quite a nice part of the city at West End. They had an extensive library, so they would let her read the books. And she would recite while she was washing the dishes, "Breeze of the man with soul so dead, who never to himself has said, this is our own, our native land," by Sir Walter Scott. They also had a little one that they had done a parody of something that was very current when she was a child, and it was, "Slowly and sadly we laid him down, we rubbed his nose with butter, we put him in a sardine tin and floated him down the gutter," which they did at Carnoogie School. My father, it wasn't a poetry he did, but he was a farmer's son, well, haulage contractor and farmer. They were a musical family, so he sang most of the time. And he sang mostly Burns. So I grew up hearing a lot of Burns and a lot of Irish singing as well, because apparently it was very popular in Scotland, so I heard a lot of Irish song. My grandmother, she had lots of little rhymes that she had again had learned as a child. She was a farmer's daughter, obviously. And she had little snippets of things like, "Charlie Chatsy milked the cats and Golachy made the cheese, and wee Willie White Bricks flinged to wa the bees."
It sounds like there was a lot of poetry of an oral rather than a written down.
It wasn't written down. When I went to school, which was one of the West End schools in the city, there was the Burns competition, of course, and my mother was very ambitious, made me learn the entire Tam O'Shanter.
Wow.
Yes, well, it took a long time. many tears. But I got there and I recited the whole thing, verbatim. And a boy recited Moose, which is very short, and he won. But I didn't want to do poetry, I went to do art.
Right. So how did you get from art to poetry then?
Folk laughed when I went to school because of the Scots, I think, you see. I remember a teacher wrote the board many, M-A-N-Y, and of course she said, what does it say? And I said, Manny. So I didn't speak too much, and then I went, in fact, when I was at five, they put me around to have an IQ test at this school. I never heard English spoken except in the wireless, because there was no television then. So I went duly round, and all I'd heard was broad Scots in the house. So a five-year-old went to see this woman, and she laid out a farm set. Now every weekend we went to my uncle's farms, and had a wonderful time with the animals and everything. So the lady said, show me a horse. In my language it was a shelt or a curry. Show me a horse. So I think I held up a sheep or something. And then, a cow. Show me a cow. Well, it would have been a coo. So again, I didn't understand a word the woman was saying. But I did hear her, and she went into the lobby and she said to another woman, not the sort we want here at all, the child's a moron.
Oh dear.
So I said to my mum on the way home, it's a moron. So when it came for the 11 plus, I was coached. Coached. Mother said, I'll nae hear them say in my bairns feel. Coached and coached until my IQ was sky high, greatly inflated, and I got to secondary. There, I had an English teacher who was the sister, I later discovered, of the poet Donald Gordon. Anyway, she gave us the ballads, introduced us to the ballads. The other English teacher, I didn't have an easy time with the English department at all, because I wanted to do art. The poems we were getting were fine, but I'd written an essay which somebody else copied.
Oh.
Little Fred, my mother wanted to, you know, encourage me to socialise. So this little Fred came home and said, have you done your essay? And I said, yes. And can I see it? And I said, yes. And proceeded to let her do whatever she was doing. And then it was with the red pen all through. And we got 45 minutes of scathing sarcasm about the lowest person in the world is a plagiarist and thief and blah, blah, blah. But of course the other girl didn't say, either did I. But I think the woman, well, she flung the book at me, it was all scored out, and she said, well, you're not capable of writing that anyway. That fine. That was Donald Gordon's sister. Then I went up to Miss Carnegie, who was also a poet. She, oh God, she's in the Scottish Poetry Library, Agnes Carnegie. She wrote a lovely report. I have it by heart. It was pretentious, precocious, and totally absurd use of language. Which actually was fair comment, because I went back into the primary school where I'd been, and they're still doing it. They wouldn't use a small word if they could find a bigger one. Mm. So they'd go through the dictionary and find the biggest word they could, and then of course didn't know what it meant. So she was fair enough. But I hated the place with a passion, so I went to Grays in fifth year to art school. Failed, which wasn't delightful. And then I went to, I'd only 3 years left of a grant, so I had to go to teacher training. There the tutor was Ian S. Munro, and he was the biographer of Grasset Gibbon. So he obviously wanted everybody to write poetry and write. And I didn't want to write, but I wanted to do art. Bill Burns, the artist, was in the art department. So I wouldn't take breaks, I would just paint. And Ian Munro came to one dinner time session. He came for a meeting with Burns, and they said, they were looking at this mess on the canvas. And Ian Munro said, I wish to God she'd concentrate on poetry, to which Burns replied, oh God, so do I.
And you never looked back?
Well, I did find it a great release, and I wrote a lot of poetry. Mm-hmm. Love means to learn to look at yourself The wire buddy looks at hine a' fairlies, for ye're ainly a' fairly amongst money, and fever sees thon why, heals his hurt without kennin' it, fair routh a sair. A birdie and a tree, said him, freen. Sign he wants to use his cell, and fairlies say they stand in the glamouries or ripeness. It doesna matter whether he kens what he serves, fa' serves best. Doesna I understand? In the middle of the TC, I had a breakdown. The doctor, the GP, arrived. He said, oh, I'll just have a wee word, it'll be fine. Then he said, no, I want to have a wee word. I think she needs outpatient counselling. So I went for outpatient counselling. I wasn't told it was a psychiatrist. I was just going to see a counsellor. She said, I didn't know what. Anyway, I was quite lucky because he was a psychotherapist from Yorkshire, working in Aberdeen, who was very interested in poetry, loved poetry. And he was also very interested in Eastern spirituality, so the pair of us got on the house and fire. So I wrote a lot of poetry then, continued to write it. But I didn't actually go into print until, I think, Cuthbert Graham, who produced a column in the Press and Journal, the local paper, he would take every Saturday a poem and put it in. And I can't remember offhand, I think the first poem I wrote in English that was published, possibly, was on the death of my father-in-law. And I described the farm and the, you know, whatever. Anyway, I got a letter from Davy Oakston saying, this is all very fine, but why are you not writing in Scots? So I thought, oh, well, no bother. So I thought, right, I'll give him Scots. So I wrote a really, really broad poem, and Cuthbert Graham and published it.
As you're saying, you don't only write in English, you write in Scots and Doric.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you have several poems about Doric as well, such as I Am a Doric Stereotype and a puckle Doric Words I Like. For people who maybe don't know or aren't familiar with Doric, what's Doric like as a language? What do you get out writing in Doric, say, rather than writing in English? Why do you feel so comfortable with Doric, apart from you were brought up in it?
That's the main reason. It's mother tongue. I've noticed recently I'm writing more and more in English, I think, because I've no Doric speaker around me.
Really?
Well, no, not really.
So you're not getting to practice it, almost?
It's not practice, but I mean, brought up in the family home, well, my grandmother stayed with us. Now, she was born into a farming community on Deeside in Logie Colston, and now I researched Doric for the university, and they said, choose your area, I choose Deeside. Thinking, of course, it's totally changed linguistically. Long ago, and still to this day, Logie Colston is like two steps back from everybody else, so the speech that my grandmother, because I shared her room, was using in the house was maybe a century older than the Scots that even my father and mother would have spoken. So I was hearing very old Scots, a throwback Scots, if you like. A lot of old words that are, you know, are obsolete now. My mother was the only one, my mother switched. She had her telephone voice and she could go English or she could go Scots. Granny and father couldn't. Because when I brought my first book of poems out, Cuthbert Graham said maybe put some glossary. So I said to my father, Fitz Trachelt in English, and he said, well, for Fochen, or Funert, or Wearied. And in the end, we ended up buying a dictionary, because really we couldn't. You know.
You were going in circles, really?
Yes, yes. And he couldn't differentiate what was English and what was whatever. And I found that when I was doing research with the, I did research for 117 children aged 11 in Deeside. And it was interesting to ask them why they chose one language over another. Or sometimes it went where they just liked the person who spoke Scots. Some of them wanted to identify with it. Some of them just couldn't stand it. Interesting. Some of them were just using it as a private language in the home. Now that's the first stage of language death.
when it retreats to the home?
Well, it's inside the home. It's the first stage of language death. Well, like Gaelic, when they start just only speaking it within the home, because they're frightened that folk will laugh at them.
And what would you say the current health, the state of health of Doric is at the moment?
It was actually quite interesting, because I came in with all the sorts of preconceived ideas, but when I did the actual research, the odd thing in the town, the school just up the road, well, I tested them in work, vocabulary, and they weren't that great, but they all said, yes, we speak Scots, because they wanted to. They identified it with almost an ethnic thing.
Mm. Interesting.
Very interesting. Much more interesting than what the university wanted me to do, which was phonemes.
Phonemes. Doric, it's getting very phonemes. Technical now, isn't it? Phonemes, yes.
A puckle Doric words I ken. A tween, a bean, a neth, a nither, black affronted. Bernie, mither, canty, vaunty, stooshy, call, crater, clachen, clipe. Twaffle, dander, dottled, dieve and dean, drukit, dreich, delechted, steen, feather, fa, fit, far and fan, feart, fash, ficher, flech and lan, funert, fikey, flitten, ba, glaikit, gaipit, gulshich, sna, hersten, herplen, hail and hoos, henny, bullies, biddies, moose, ingins, apples, neeps, eltricket, jaloosed, jaco, dumfunert, strippet, kirk, kist, lochen, lugs and loons, lead, laird, leerig, queets and croons, foggy bummer, futret, fushty, fair for fochen, fowk and roosty, gansy, greeting, guddle, gipe, gangrel, greeting, minket, swipe, money, moche, mules, and meer, nuke, oot, ora, onding, sweer, puckle, peely wally, peer, quine, reeve, riggin, recht, and meer, raken, rose, routh, contermashes, scaffy, scutter, skellach, fashes, simmet, sutter, spearin, scale, scunnet, stammy gaster, kale, tatty, juchter, thrapple, thocht, trachled, tunzer, thran and socht, wabbit, water, widen, wark, wasn't, yowie, wifey, sark, oxters, shooters, chee jars, dyke, add as many as mares you like.
I would say that Aberdeen is to you what New York is to Woody Allen, or the Lake District is to Wordsworth. It seems to inspire you greatly. There's a lot of Aberdeen poems about Aberdeen. You've mapped the territory very thoroughly from...
Like a cat.
Yeah.
Very splayed it, yes.
Yeah, well, from the nicer areas to the less nice areas.
Yes,
what's it about Aberdeen that, you know, inspires you so?
Well, I come from the place, you know.
Yeah.
I like the change, the shift in the language. I quite like the Aberdonian. It's quite gritty. They can be... I wouldn't say doer, reserved. There was a person of European origin at the university who would embrace everybody, you know, and bear hugs. And I thought, now, just wait a minute here. You know, you've got to be really an extremist before you give an embrace in the Northeast to people you don't know, you know, if you were dying, maybe, yes.
Yeah,
you
maybe.
Yeah, maybe. You can't go overboard, but... That's who we're.
And Aberdeen itself, it's more the inhabitants than the geography or the climate or the landscape. That's what interests you.
I haven't done so many rural poems recently because I haven't been in the rural situation. But the city is a huge kaleidoscope of culture now because I still teach there.
Mm.
And in one class I'm in, out of the 18 children, 15 are Lithuanian or Polish or Russian.
Mm.
So life's rich pattern.
Continues, yes.
Very, very much so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I love my city with its growling skies, its chiselled features and its trading fleet, its windy thoroughfares, the seagull cries ringing above the clash of Union Street. I love the huddle of the fitty wines, the curlicues of Marshall's soaring spires, the echo through the har of ancient chants sung in the Smyr by dead Franciscan friars. I love the way the town clings to the tide, the shingly, tingly, rhythmic slush of shale, breaking the North Sea into shining shards, driven by wind and salted by the hail. I love the atriums of glassy malls, the medieval masonry of kings, grey herons fishing in the dee and dawn, the landward V of geese's beating wings. I love the cats on Union Terrace Bridge, the clickety-clack of speeding trains beneath, the Mither Kirk's green lung, Oasis space, such gems as city forefathers bequeath to us as trustees of this ancient place, this northern light with granite carapace.
In the introduction to the new Best and Selected Poems, Alan Spence, who's written an introduction, says that you've written over 100 pamphlets.
105, yes.
105 now. Glad to be corrected. Where do you find the time, energy and inspiration? That's an incredible tally. That's a real amount of work.
Well, I think a lot of people would say, get a life. It's a bit like the horrible expression, an anorak, you know, who there's train numbers. That is how I relate to the world.
That's how you see the world, through poetry.
Through poetry. Well, I was left very much to my own devices when I was wee. We would stay every summer in Ballater because my father was manager of the local bus company, which is from Braemar to Aberdeen. They would open the door in the morning, give me some sandwiches and Cheerio, and I would just wander about. I was all over the place, and up the hills and down, and rivers, and I mean, I could have died, drowned, and been eaten by marauding badgers, and nobody would have noticed. You're used to having conversations with yourself, but it is very much a way of relating with the world around.
You were saying to me earlier on as well that you're not precious about where you write the poetry. You can write on a bus. You seem to be able to write poetry anywhere.
More or less, yes. I'm trying to think of the worst place I've written. Possibly a toilet in India. I've no sense of smell, so I score, you see.
You might not be surprised to know this, you know, but you're the only person I've ever interviewed who's, you know, only poet I've ever interviewed who's said that they've written a poem in a toilet in India.
Well, they don't live, you know, they should get out more.
Yeah, indeed.
Bits of paper, because if you don't write it down, you forget it.
True, very true.
It is.
You've also translated into Scots the work of different poets, John Clare, Rilke, Milosh. What makes a certain poet work well in Scots? Or, you know, you read a poem and you go, that would sound...
Now, I've been thumped in this by... So I've got bloody noses in this by... I'm not saying the person I don't like him. But, you know, how dare you? Because I always say that it's from an English translation of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, who's going to read? I don't know Japanese nor the rest of it. But what interests me is how people think. And if they've got a really unusual idea, I think, oh, I'd love to hear that in Scots, or I'd love to write that in Scots, because share it with other people. So why not?
Mm, why not? Why not, indeed? And was the criticism that you really should be doing it from the original German?
Oh, yes, of course.
Japanese?
Yes.
Right, I see. So the Academy felt offended there, did it?
Well, the literatees.
Ah, don't want to do that, do we?
Oh, you mustn't.
Am I right in thinking you've got a Buddhist dimension to your work? Is that something that interests you, spirituality?
Yes. When I had the first breakdown, that was just the year, 2 years after I came out of Grays. And I'd made a head of Buddha in the garden, you see. So when the GP came in, He said, has she been doing anything unusual? And I said, well, there's a wood out in the garden. And he went, oh, Cornhill, straight away.
Really?
More or less.
Cornhill, for people who are listening, is a...
psychiatric establishment, is an outpatient. There's always been a visual dimension to the poetry because of the art side. So you can tell poets who are... In fact, I tried to do it, but I didn't have the... I did not have the academic nous to carry it out. I sent out questionnaires to poets asking how they thought. Did they think in moving pictures, still images, black and white, purely words? George Bruce said he only thought in stills.
Hmm.
You know, like putting in slides. Most poets wrote back and said they thought like a moving film.
Hmm.
One or two folks said they only heard words, they had no pictures at all. Some people thought in black and white pictures. One man, God help him, thought in pure geometric shapes. But he was a mathematician. So the visual side has always greatly interested me in writing visual poetry. You can tell if people maybe don't think in pictures because their work is very cerebral. It's dry and there's not much imagery going on. I had a second breakdown. Oh, God. We're about 40, I suppose. And leading into that, I was very creative. Oh, I was awake. I was hardly sleeping. I was painting, I was writing, and I was up half the night. But very visual, and it was surrealist. So I managed to discover where the Yorkshire psychotherapist was, and he was at the... down in Sheffield at the Centre for Psychotherapeutic Research. So we linked up my post. I think you got a bit of a shock, I mean a 20-year lapse, never mind. And he would send up pictures and I would respond with poetry. And we had a sort of trade-off that he could use my poetry with his students. I was quite happy for that. But I found it very useful. And so it's very therapeutic poetry as well.
I was thinking almost the amount of poems you write and your interest in Buddhism is almost maybe like meditation, you know,
mm-hmm.
using that to sort of as a way to sort of get out of yourself and see things
in
a different
yeah.
way.
Yes, coming from a very stinch Kirk of Scotland upbringing, my grandfather, who I never met, thank God, was a presenter in the local church.
What's a presenter for those of us
sing.
Who are...
Well, I see, if he didn't have an organ, then the presenter would strike a tuning fork and he would hold the note and then he would lead you in the hymns. So he was a local farmer who was the presenter. And my mother was very religious. Yes. Church every Sunday. My father was. He had a great belief in the mountains and the hills. I mean, we had one of those ministers who used to terrify folk. He would rattle around in his little box and I used to think, God help us if he gets out. And it was all about hellfire. Everybody's going to die. Fry. Hell. If you were Catholic, any other religion but the Church of Scotland. So we were on a little cloud up there. And I used to think, the man's insane. It happens to everybody else in the world, you know. But he did. I had nightmares about that man. It was like a merry-go-round, you couldn't get off. I wrote a story about it and he said, oh God, you know these horrible horsey things that go round and round forever, especially with him on it. I thought, well, a sensible religion that suits me is Buddhism.
Mm.
And it suited me very well.
There's a lot of humour as well in your poetry, Shuna.
Mm.
In a handbag darkly and things I would not put on my CV. You've got to have a laugh, don't you?
Well, you must. You must. Yes, because there's two sides. There's the light and shade. And the last pamphlet that I just handed in to the library is very dreary. But then it was in the battlefields in Flanders, so it was across there. And there's not a great deal to laugh about across there, but usually, yes, you can see the funny side of it.
And what was it like visiting the killing fields of Flanders? A somber experience, it sounds like.
The oddest thing is the juxtaposition of the Flanders Museum, you know, where it's beautiful. Well, that's a strange word to use, beautiful, isn't it? There's a very good German installation. A German artist has done an installation using First World War artefacts. which is quite powerful. The whole thing's powerful. But then you come from that into the square at Ypres, where there is something like Cadonas. There's a carousel, and there's a fun fair, and everybody's got shooting guns and everything, and stuffing themselves with frites. It's an odd positioning.
And that wraps up another SPL podcast. It falls to me to thank Sheena for coming into the SPL to record her interview. Actually, as I recall that day, there was building work going on across the road from the library, and it was so noisy, we ended up having to take a taxi out to my flat to record the podcast. So again, thank you to Sheena for all of that. Thanks also to Will Campbell, who wrote and performs music you hear at the start and at the close of the podcast. And thanks to you, of course, for listening. If you want to learn more about the SPL, you can go to www.spl.org.uk. That takes you to the homepage of our website. You can also visit our social media channels. Would you believe we tweet at By Leaves We Live? That's our Twitter handle. And we also have a Facebook page. Of course we do. Everybody has a Facebook page these days. We'll have another podcast in about a fortnight, but before I sign off, why don't we have one last poem by Sheena?
This is not Vienna. No feeding of pigeons or seagulls. They shit in the civic statues, dive bomb travellers. We are a cold city. Don't complain. Wear thermal underwear or stay at home. The Bacchanalia takes place from Fridays to Mondays. Those of a nervous nature should stay indoors. No nudism on the beach, no smacking children. Despite the provocation, they have rights. Don't weigh us in the scales beside Ibiza. Don't treat us like braille with hugs or familiar touching. We are not interactive till we grow to know you. And that may take a year or two, my friend.
Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at By Leaves We Live, and find us on Facebook.